51551 is the text. You can tweet the programme at RTE Arena. On The Late Late Show in 1969, Gay Byrne hosted a special 70th birthday programme for the great actor Micheál MacLaymore. MacLaymore was an actor and director who, along with his theatrical and life partner, Hilton Edwards, set up the Gate Theatre. MacLaymore was born, not as he claimed, in County Cork, but in London, and his real name was Alfred Wilmore. But to Ireland, he was the Irish-speaking thespian Micheál MacLaymore. Back on The Late Late in 1969, Gay Byrne introduced the MacLaymore to rapturous applause.
I think it was Maureen Potter who was singing Happy Birthday to you there in that
moment. As long as she doesn't start, he's a jolly good fellow, I am happy. I don't care what happens if that doesn't happen.
I wouldn't at
but
all.
Whatever Maureen started, I'd be happy, so there we are.
Well, don't depend on us not starting for he's a jolly good fellow. Why not, incidentally?
I don't know, it gives me the creeps. It doesn't agree with my stomach. An awful song, isn't it, Kate?
Now, Michael, I've been compelled to ask you straight away, why are you now admitting to being 70 years of age?
I have never admitted to being anything else. I think I emerged from my mother's womb at the age of 70. I felt very old as a child, and I feel younger and younger as the years go by. I think it's owing to all that fresh air and exercise I get. And it's the exercise is chiefly in a desperate and perpetual struggle to get my own way in everything, which keeps my muscles going.
How did you react to all of those marvellous things which were said about
you? Exquisitely embarrassed. And I think it had all the charm of a great work of fiction. I only wish my partner had heard it. Oh, I'm delighted he didn't, because life at home would be unbearable, because he would wait for, that was that late, late show that's made you more impossible than ever, you see.
Micheál MacLaymore there on The Late Late Show in 1969. MacLaymore's appearance on that Late Late episode is the inspiration for a new play produced by Phoebeen Sathaiviark. It's written by Anton O'Flaherty. It's called Walsall Na Bhaile, and its director, Stephen Darcy, is in our Galway studio this evening. First of all, delighted to talk with you, Stephen. We want to wish Anton well. I believe he's unwell at the moment, so hopefully things will improve for him in the coming days and weeks. But to the play that he's given us, which is quite the piece indeed, it's the story of Micheál MacLaymore, who played such a central role in the Tyveark as its first artistic director. Tell me a little bit about that relationship, MacLaymore's relationship with Galway.
Yeah, that's right. Thanks, Sean. Thanks very much for having us on. I absolutely echo that. Good wishes to Anton as well. Yeah, MacLaymore was the first artistic director of An Taibhearc. When it was founded, they dragged him in as the first artistic director. But I think he was dragged in rather willingly, because at the same time he was founding the Gay Theatre in Dublin. And An Taibhearc, founded by Liam O'Brien, they managed to get some funding together, and that basically bankrolled him while also setting up the Gate in Dublin. So he was artistic director of the Tyveark first, produced plays there first, and then went to the Gate. So it was a helpful, not necessarily lucrative, but it was beneficial for him to be at An Taibhearc at the same time as setting up the Gate.
Yeah, and I suppose there's a kind of an element of him coming home in a different way with this play of Anton's. And I believe that clip, we just heard that clip from the episode of The Late Late from 1969. Mm-hmm. That was very much part of the starting point of the play for Anton.
Yeah, there are quite a few sort of inspirations. Anton has been so generous in sharing all of this, and he has also said, and he says this in his programme note too, that there's more of himself in one of the characters in this play than in any other play in anything else he's ever written. And that character is the character of the guard. And you haven't mentioned him yet. Mm. The guard is sort of the vessel for speaking to MacLaymore, because, you know, how do you speak to a great actor who's no longer with us? But he has his MacGuffin, or his setup in the play is that MacLaymore's on his way home and he's intercepted by a guard, and then the guard escorts him home, guard the escort home, and talks him through his life. But the sort of the strange characteristic of the guard is that he jumps through time, and he brings MacLaymore back to his place of birth, back in Kensal Green, and he brings him forward into the future, into pretty much present day Ireland. So it's a lovely device that Anton has used there.
Yeah, I suppose in some ways I think Anton has said that, you know, he gets the guard to ask the questions that Anton O'Flaherty himself, and maybe many people who saw that episode of The Late Late would have wanted to have asked. I mean, he's highly entertaining, but he's very careful in what he says and what he doesn't say.
Yeah, I mean, that's key, isn't it? You can listen to any clip of McNamara. He's so incredibly entertaining to listen to. And not necessarily saying funny things, but it's his whole persona, his personality, his voice. There's this great performative quality to it. And, you know, I think you could listen to it all day long and be entertained. But there's also the sense that perhaps he's... you know, it's a veil of sorts behind which maybe there's another person. We don't really know who that other person is. We don't know what a conversation was like back home between McLeamore and Hilton Edwards, for example. But we imagine it, or Anton has imagined it in our play Waltz Ala Walia. Essentially, the whole play, from when he's intercepted by this guard, it's effectively him trying to get home to his partner. And it's beautiful the way in that Late Late Show clip, he says, "My partner," which can be taken in many ways. But, you know, and I suppose in a court of law, a partner, he's simply saying, "It's my work partner. I've worked with him all my life." And yet we hear it now in different ways. So there are echoes through the play as well of things that maybe resonate differently today to how they would have done at the time.
Because we could say that we should say that one of the reasons that the guard intercepts McLeamore potentially looking for seeking sex from a young sex worker, and he intercedes. The guard intercedes or intercepts that particular assignation. He stops it from happening. I mean, at the time. We're talking about that would have had beyond serious implications for Micheál McNamara or any man, in fact.
Well, that's right. Yeah, and anybody. It's exactly that, and that's sort of apocryphal story of McLeamore being walked home by a guard. And it seems that he enjoyed cottaging. He enjoyed going to these public toilets, which were renowned cottaging sort of spots. And on this occasion, this guard walked him home. And I suppose Anton O'Flaherty is wondering, well, what did they chat about? You know, why did it not become a national scandal? Perhaps was the guard himself gay? There's so many questions. And effectively what Anton is, I think, trying to do in this play, and it's a beautiful play, what he's trying to do is to pose these questions. A lot of them are open-ended questions. It's not a condemnation of anything, but it puts him in some tricky situations and the guard cross-examines him, puts him on the stand and says, well, why did you do this? Why didn't you do that? But ultimately, the guard does bring him home to Hilton and I think we see a sort of a happy ending of sorts.
Yes. Yeah. Let's have a listen to a clip from, this is quite early on in the
Very
play,
early, yeah.
in fact, where Micheál is in doing a VO. He's doing a voiceover. He's reading from the book of Genesis, from the Bible, but for a very unusual type of situation. You might explain why he's reading from the book of Genesis.
Oh, yeah. This is actually a piece from the song God Created Woman by the band The Freshmen. And The Freshmen were a great show band in Ireland in the late 60s, early 70s.
Yeah.
But they were sort of just slightly maybe out or ahead of their own time. But one of their songs, the whole album is absolutely terrific, God Created Woman. But there's a piece of Genesis in this, and then it breaks into this beautiful song. So McLeamore's voice introduces all the tracks on the album, and it's speaking this sort of biblical speak.
So here he is. with the sound engineer, who's in a bit of a hurry because there's another show band on the way.
Yeah,
in fact,
another band coming from Limerick, yeah.
Sean O'Dowd and Dingaling. So this is the exchange between Catherine and the Warachu as Micheál McLeamore and the sound engineer.
Again, if you don't mind.
I think that was perfect.
No, again. From the beginning.
Okay.
In the beginning. In the beginning, God created the heavens and the earth, and God said, no, 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 no.
From
no,
out here, that
no.
sounds perfect.
Well, from in here, it does not.
There's a band coming in at 5:30, so we have to be out of here.
You already mentioned the band several times.
Apologies.
Sean O'Dowd and Ding-a-ling.
Yeah. They're coming up from Limerick.
What is your name?
Alan.
Alan. This is what we are going to do, Alan. You are going to allow me as many takes as I need to create something absolutely faultless. Something beautiful we both can be proud of. Even if it means discommoding Mr. O'Dowd and his companions, Ding-a-ling.
Okay.
Splendid. Let us go again then, from the start, from the heart, and from the heavens.
In your own time, Mr. McLemore.
There you go, a clip from Phoebe's new production, our production of the new Anton O'Flaherty play, Walsall, while you're all about Micheál McLemore. And obviously, Stephen Darcy, director of the play, is with me on the line this evening from Galway, in the Galway studio. Stephen, obviously, we have to remark on the fact that it's Catriona Ní Mhuircheall who's playing the part of Micheál McLemore. Yeah. Why did you decide to mix the genders in that way?
It was very much, my starting point was to find someone whose Irish is very true, you know, or maybe native, if you will, and would speak Munster Irish. And so I went through a list, I made a list, and I kept going, yes, but there was something, there was an element missing. And I was in conversation with my own partner, Siobhan O'Kelly, actress Siobhan O'Kelly, who was saying, look, I'd mentioned Catriona a few times, and she was going, maybe there's something in that, you know, because, yeah. And when I thought about that further, it was that, by having Catriona play McLemore, there's already, you're watching the character at a distance, you know. Yeah. You're seeing someone wearing a mask to play the role. So, you know, if, for example, I was playing McLemore, it would just be me saying words, but there's something about how Catriona is able to try and embody him, but we also know that she's doing something else. And I think it, you know, she does such a brilliant job. I think she's extraordinary casting. When I phoned her about it, she actually told me that she had been writing a play about McLemore, but it was on the shelf. So there you go.
Just one final thing before I go to a little bit of George Michael to finish up. The importance of being Oscar was a one-man show that McLemore performed over 12 years. You managed to bring Mac and Oscar together. The time travelling is a great thing. And well, yeah. I suppose Anton O'Flaherty manages to do that.
He certainly does. I mean, yeah, once we're time travelling, it's sort of...
Anything is possible.
Anything's possible. Who do you want to meet? And I mean, you know, for us, for McLemore to meet his hero, effectively, yeah. Oscar Wilde, is a beautiful opportunity. But Oscar Wilde doesn't give it to him all his own way either.
No,
so
no.
That's, yeah.
finally, why am I going to finish up why am I going to finish up with a little clip of Outside...
Yeah, George Michael, because George Michael, you know, was caught cottaging himself and was got in big trouble with the police in LA about it, got arrested. Mm. And his response to this some years later was to write this song, Outside, about accepting that he was a gay man. And Oscar Wilde begins his part of the show by singing this song.
A little bit of George Michael.
That's it. Ben Morris actor sings it, yeah.
All right. Well, listen, thanks for sharing that with us. Garmila Maha, good Stephen. That's what I think. Outside from George Michael, and a wonderful explanation from Stephen Darcy there of how that all fits into Walsall, the new play from Anton O'Flaherty. It runs from tomorrow night, March the 21st, through until April the 1st. Phoebean Sataivyark, and you can find out full information on taivyark.com. We are moving to different type of goth experience, I suppose. Once upon a time, a certain tribe of teenagers and 20-somethings threw themselves around a dance floor to new tracks by The Cure or The Cult or Sisters of Mercy. This was the 1980s, and those fans and bands were known, of course, as goths. Think of The Cure frontman Robert Smith, dressed in black, hair dyed black, face painted white, doomed romantic look to match the gloomy romantic lyrics and music. A new book, The Art of Darkness, The History of Goth by John Robb, explores this extraordinary time in some 700 pages, placing it in a larger cultural context and talking to some of the original players. Peter Murphy has been reading the book for us, and he's with me in studio now. I suppose, you know, it mightn't have been foreseen at the time, when you think about it, Peter, you know, that The Cure would be as popular today, possibly, or maybe even more popular right now. A live band still touring, still selling out. But strictly speaking, the heyday of this goth era, we're talking about 1979 to 1987. Just remind us of that time and that, I suppose, that aesthetic quality that the goths gave us.
Okay, so there's been a reappraisal of this period. Everybody's been banging on about punk rock for years and years and years and the importance of it. A lot of people are now revisiting it and going, actually, the 7 or 8 years that came after punk rock were incredibly fertile and incredibly disparate and incredibly innovative. And the interesting thing about goth is nobody would own up to it. Only the worst bands. The irony is this: anybody who called themselves a goth band was usually the worst, the runts of the litter. And the best practitioner of the form always would say, "We're not a goth band." That could have been The Cure. It could have been Susie and the Banshees. It could have been the Sisters of Mercy. It could have been the Cult, Fields of the Nephilim. You name it.
Are you going to admit now that you were a goth yourself and on the dance floor at one time?
I would never have admitted to it at the time, but looking back on it, there was hairspray, there was backcombing, there was soap, there was plucking, there was shrieking. But, you know,
you're reappraising your own history here.
Absolutely. In this book, a large part of the pleasure of this book is looking back on it. I mean, goths were sneered at in the hip popular press. And, you know, Dave Lee Roth once said that critics love Elvis Costello because they all look like him.
You've said that this book, The Art of Darkness, it's a kind of a putting history right. Is it that sneering attitude that you think needs to be addressed and needs to be reappraised, to use that word again?
Yeah, and like a word about the author, like John Robb is a 61-year-old Lancashire-born culture journalist and author of like Stone Roses biographies and oral histories in Manchester. But crucially, he's the bass player and singer in a band called Membranes, who were pretty well-regarded post-punk band who are still touring, so well-regarded that My Bloody Valentine had them on at a curated festival several years ago. Mm. So Rob approaches it as an evangelist rather than a critic. So he has not a bad word to say about anybody throughout this entire book. Oh. Rather than talk about something he doesn't like, he'd rather omit it. So his tone is very effusive and enthusiastic, and it has the effect of making you feel incredibly inspired and driven down the absolute rabbit hole of YouTube clips, watching Old Grey Whistle Test, and I don't know if you remember The Tube on Channel 4. And these were crucial programs in terms of looking at The Damned or looking at old footage. Yeah.
And looking at them was one thing, and you probably, you know, if you do go down the YouTube rabbit hole, you'll probably see very similar visuals from band to band, from one exponent of the form to another. But you'll hear very different sounds.
Yeah, the term goth is a catch-all. It could be anything from dark psychedelia to black metal to post-punk to one of the points that Rob brings up is that the dance floor was crucial. In many cases, the strongholds of the youth movement that was goth, which is basically people from 16 to 24 wearing ripped fishnets and old army surplus and Victoriana. It is a congregation of people around a dance floor, very often in regional towns like, well, the big cities, Liverpool and Manchester, but it wasn't a London-centric phenomenon. It was, Northampton and Bradford and not hip places, Leeds, Sisters of Mercy, Bauhaus, all these bands were not from hip media centres. So these were resilient characters living, they had to run a gamut of teddy boys and skinheads before they even got here. So there were an extraordinary...
They were already survivors.
Tribe.
Yeah. Okay, you've mentioned the Sisters of Mercy. Let's start with, what other way would a goth song start than with some thunder and lightning? Interestingly, Peter Murphy, as we were listening to this Corrosion from the Sisters of Mercy, you were saying That's a disco track.
That's a dance track.
Of course, you know, it is a dance track. You can, if you take that baritone voice away and you raised it up a few notches, you'd be on the floor for that.
Yeah, there's some really interesting stuff in the book about the importance of dance music and black music on goth. So we're talking about dance tracks, disco, downtown disco from the late 70s, but also dub, Jamaican dub, deep dub was a huge influence on stuff like Public Image Limited and the big heavy bass sounds of Bauhaus, and also how the bands were all configured. Nobody ever taught him the rules of music, so that everybody was trying to play lead at the same time. But there was an enormous amount of space in it as well. So it was a period where the bass players were all like lead guitar players. So you had Jah Wobble from Public Image Limited, or you had Peter Hook from New Order, Joy Division and later New Order, and these amazing chorus pedal, driving bass sounds, really inventive guitar sounds, baritone voice, usually very deep, doomy voice, and a big whacking backbeat.
Yeah. But the book we're talking about, we should say, is The Art of Darkness, The History of Goth by John Robb, and Peter Murphy had been reading it first. It doesn't just deal with this period in time. It doesn't deal with just 1979 through to 1987. It goes right back in time to the very origins, not punk, way, way back in time to the origins of goth.
Yeah, there's about a 200-page prequel on goth architecture, on Goya, on biblical history, all the way up through the romantic poets, Keats, Coleridge, Shelley.
And that's the first third of the book.
That's the first 150 pages anyway, and also Edgar Allan Poe, right up then into the early days of cinema, Morticia Adams and Nosferatu and Murnau and German Expressionism, and how important the visual aesthetic was and how it bled into the Holy Trinity in the late 60s, the Doors, the Stooges, the Velvet Underground, into Bowie and the German electronic band. I mean, this is a really rich, there's a way to look at this book as to say the history of goth is just another way of looking at the history of a darker tinged alternative culture or subculture that goes through a century and a half.
And who is it for in that regard?
It's for people my age and also people my daughter's age who are bizarrely listening to shoegaze music or bizarrely paying 400 times what I paid for the vinyl version of the Velvet Underground's first album.
And do you think it's that kind of cross-generational thing that has led to this reappraisal of goth right now?
Well, look at, go on to Netflix, take a look at Wednesday. There's an iconic dance sequence in episode 2 in which Wednesday Addams is dancing to Goo Goo Muck by the Cramps, which has sent the Cramps' Spotify stats through the roof. The Cramps being your classic trash culture 50s monster movie zombie vampire schlockabilly rockabilly American Sons of Alice Cooper.
I'll finish with The Cult and She Sells Sanctuary. How important are The Cult in the midst of all of this?
They completely came out of post-punk, inspired by the Sex Pistols, were the Southern Death Cult, and were very huge, important part of goth, the use of tribal rhythms and multicultural elements. And The Cult started out that way and then ended up as a garish hard rock caricature.
That's The Art of Darkness. No, that's not. That's The Cult and She Sells Sanctuary and The Art of Darkness, The History of Goth, published by Manchester University Press, is what Peter Murphy was talking about. Peter has an interview with John Robb in this weekend's Irish Times, and John Robb is in conversation with Gavin Friday and photographer Karma Figures at BIM on June the 1st. But the book we've been speaking about, The Art of Darkness, The History of Goth by John Robb, published by Manchester University Press. Dutch master Johannes Vermeer is best known for his tranquil, introverted indoor scenes, his unprecedented use of bright, colourful light and his illusionism. As his paintings are generally considered the most prized treasures of every museum collection, Vermeer paintings are rarely lent out. But Amsterdam's Rijksmuseum, their new Vermeer exhibition, will be the largest ever solo showing of paintings by the Dutch artist, encompassing 28 works from all over the world, borrowed from collections from everywhere, from Japan to the US to our own National Gallery. The exhibition will include masterpieces such as The Girl with the Pearl Earring, Lady Writing a Letter and Her Maid, and Woman Holding a Balance. The museum also provides a comprehensive online exploration of all of his 37 paintings, narrated by Stephen Fry, joined now by Jessica Fahey, who has luckily been one of the lucky ones to get to Amsterdam to see the Vermeer exhibition. What is so special, first of all, Jess, about this particular exhibition at the Rijksmuseum in Amsterdam?
So essentially, it's 8 years in the making, and it was a rare opportunity where the Frick were going to have their museum closed so they could loan their three paintings, which they never loan. There was another recent purchase, one that's on loan in Japan, that was able to come. So I think the curators just saw this ideal moment where they could get as many Vermeers as they possibly could together with nothing else. So it's a weirdly stark exhibition, even though it is sort of luxurious in how it's staged as well. But it's just Vermeer. It's simply titled Vermeer. There's no subtitle to the exhibition or anything. It's just him and very little else in terms of the exhibition.
Well, that might please him, given his, you could argue, minimalism, I suppose, in some ways. Let's tweet, I suppose, what is the best known image of Johannes Vermeer, for many reasons, not least of which is a film and a book. But the painting itself, clearly, Girl in a Turban, or Girl with a Pearl Earring, from Johannes Vermeer at RTE Arena, to see that very, very familiar Vermeer image. How much does this exemplify what it was that Vermeer did, particularly with these solo female subjects, Jess?
Yeah, so essentially the exhibition for me is about seeing these paintings glow, because he did something that nobody else of that era was doing. He was able to make this sort of transmission of light come out of the paintings, which is a prime example of The Girl with the Pearl Earring. Interestingly, it wasn't that well known. It sold for nothing in the 1880s. You know, it's really quite recent that people care about it at all as a painting, care about Vermeer at all. So it's, you know, we joke about the novel and the film, but actually it's one of the reasons why it's so famous.
Yeah.
But it was described, even in a 17th century inventory, as being a particularly good example of a head. And what they mean by head is a word used in Dutch, a tronie, which is kind of like a characterful face, hence the turban, hence the earring. So she's not meant to be a portrait. We're not meant to know who she is. She's certainly not the character in the book or any of that kind of thing. She's just someone he had sit and turned into this interesting Turkish kind of character, essentially. And previous to the examinations of this painting, they sort of believed that she was an idealized head, because she doesn't really have eyelashes, not much of an eyebrow, similar to the Mona Lisa. But in actual fact, since they've studied it more closely, they've realized that those things were there. And actually, the painting was very poorly damaged before it was sold in the 1880s. The other thing they found out was that it should have a green curtain. The background shouldn't be black. So then that makes it more set in the real world than this kind of nowhere land that she's makes her more provocative.
Yeah, there's something quite filmic, almost theatrical about this, because it's almost as if she's standing on maybe a stage set as opposed to a film set. Because
absolutely.
It's just like a studio backdrop behind her. There's nothing there. It's
exactly.
Just this dark blue colour.
Yeah, no, absolutely. And that's what makes it feel kind of modern to us, I think, as well. Whereas if actually we could see the green curtain, it wouldn't have the same impact, interestingly. So it's damaged, helped it. Yeah.
I must say, I listened to some of the narration from Stephen Fry today, and it is extraordinary he manages to do with it. Let's have a listen to what he has to say about that particular painting.
Mm-hmm.
There she is, the girl with the pearl earring. Quite the picture, don't you think? Her eyes meet our own with a piercing, perhaps mischievous look. She's beautiful, with her smooth skin and slightly parted lips. Enchantingly beautiful. Her perfectly proportioned face and soft facial features are exactly what people found beautiful at the time. No wonder, then, that people later tried to discover her identity. But they were always on a hopeless mission, because it's likely she was mostly dreamed up by Vermeer. She's simply too perfect to be real. Her headdress looks like a Turkish turban. In the Turkish Empire, it was men who wore this kind of head covering. It's not the usual kind of accessory for a Dutch girl, but it's certainly mysterious. Her coat is a quite ordinary item of clothing for the period, but as far as we know, there weren't any dyed this ochre colour. That means it must also have been dreamt up by Vermeer. There is the piece of jewellery for which she is so famous. This huge pearl must have been very expensive. It's highly unlikely it actually belonged to Vermeer because he was still an unknown artist at the time. He probably painted it from an imitation pearl, or else used his imagination and painted it in just a few strokes. All these elements together make for a mysterious woman, a blend of fantasy and reality.
There we go. That's Stephen Fry from the online narration to not just the 28 paintings that are in the current Vermeer exhibition at the Rijksmuseum in Amsterdam, but in fact to all 37. Mm-hmm. And several of the aspects of what he says there, Jess Fahey, you would take not umbrage, but you'd certainly question. First of all, and I kind of thought this looking at myself, well, is that a pearl? Is it? It kind of looks more like a silver earring than a pearl earring.
You're dead right. It absolutely is. It also doesn't connect to her ear. And believe me, they've looked at this painting as close as they could. So we know in this era, pearls were incredibly expensive. A pearl that size, there's no chance he owned it. And there's certainly no chance that this young model owned it. So it's much more likely actually a piece of tin that's painted to look sort of pearl-esque.
Yeah.
And sometimes they would actually have like a piece of glass that they'd put wax in that's coloured to make it look like a pearl as well.
Now, obviously, we were going to start with that one, but ironically, and I'm going to tweet the second image now, which is not what we expect from Vermeer at all. This is View of Delft, a big exterior painting from Johannes Vermeer. And this is what you see in the first room of the exhibition, Jess. That's interesting that they've chosen to put that as the opening item, if you like.
Yeah, it's almost like they're kind of, you know, bearing the lead a little bit because everyone's expecting a certain type of Vermeer. But actually, for me, I thought it was perfect. It was a great idea because we know that he painted, in terms of records, that there's three works that were exterior scenes and two
have
survived.
Sorry, I should say at RTÉ Arena if you want to see the image that Jess is talking about now.
So two have survived, this View of Delft and then another one that's a view of the street that he lived on. And they're both in this one room. And that's all that's in the room. So again, back to that kind of sparseness. But these paintings, when you see them in person, it's quite an extraordinary effect because you're very aware of being a painting from, you know, 350 years ago. Yet when you look at it closely and stand in front of it, it looks like a photograph. And this is long before photography. And there's long been a debate over whether or not Vermeer used camera obscuras or mirrors or things like that.
I suppose particularly when we see it's the reflections of the buildings in the water, very photographic.
Yeah, and scientists have looked at this and they don't think our eyes can record this type of light effect, that we only are aware of it because of things like camera obscuras or photography. So it sort of points to maybe that's what's going on. But when you stand in front of it, the weird effect that it has is that rolling cloud feels like it's going over your head. It's very illusionistic and something that I hadn't really expected.
Yeah, because I must say, and I've listened to quite a bit of the Stephen Fry narration across the thing earlier in the day, and he kind of talks about this as it's a kind of realism, but it's not realistic at all. Because one of the other things is the way, it struck me as very cinematic, the way at the very centre of the painting, the inside of the city is lit with sunlight.
Yeah, and it's bizarre because, I mean, cloud effect does work that way, but we don't really read it
easily.
But the other thing that's extraordinary about it is that this was painted about 6 years after what was known as the Delft Thunderclap, which was where the magazine where they kept gunpowder exploded. And artists like Carl Fabricius, who is famous for painting the Goldfinch, who may or may not have been Vermeer's teacher, some people think, he was killed in it along with about 100 people. About 1,000 were injured and most of the city was destroyed by it. And anyone else painting Delft in and around this time shows the damage, whereas Vermeer completely ignores it and almost pretends it isn't there. And he moves things around to make the composition more pleasing. So on one hand, it looks photorealistic. And then the other, we know that he's playing with reality.
Let me skip on to the kitchen maid, the milkmaid. Again, realism on the surface at RTE Arena to see this particular image. It looks like a maid pouring milk from a jug into a bowl. But tell us how he changes that from realism into something else, Jess.
Yeah, so the thing about Vermeer is that he comes along with the kind of second era of the Dutch Republic. So the first era of the Dutch Republic was new money and people spent it in, you know, brothels and inns, and, you know, a lot of the paintings reflect that kind of bawdy life. By the time you get to the second generation, the aspirations and the ideals of what you are supposed to be as a Dutch citizen start to change. And one of the things in particular that's related to Protestantism and sort of different ways of viewing the world is this idea of a perfect domestic household where everything works perfectly. You have an industrious servants. You yourself are educated and well put together. So even something as simple as her just working here shows not just the plentiful abundance of what they have in the house, but also how sophisticated and evolved the Dutch Republic are.
And again, the narration is very interesting in this, in that it tells us about what was on the back wall. The back wall is like just like a blank white wall behind her in this image. But there were other things there before that. There were shelves and all things that he decided to take away. Was he a big reviser of his work in that respect?
It's sort of bizarre because it doesn't really seem that he was that often. I mean, we certainly know some cases where figures were taken out and moved around. What seems to have happened a little bit more often is that later restorers have added in or taken over parts of the painting, which is a little bit bizarre. The honest answer when it comes to anything to do with Vermeer is we don't know, because he's sometimes called the Sphinx of Delft, because we have no written record, no letters, no diaries. The only things we know about him are sort of births, deaths and marriages, and, you know, the kind of official accounts from the locality, but nothing about him personally, how long he took to paint, none of that. We just don't know.
So this, the online resource, which is called Closer to Vermeer, how important is that? Because we won't, most of us are not going to get to this exhibition. Well, it's sold out already, isn't it?
It is.
You're not going to get a ticket unless you already have one.
Yeah, 500,000 tickets sold out. I don't think it's ever happened before with an exhibition. So yeah, you can go online. The resource there are very good. The catalogue is fantastic. Particularly if you're interested in a more in-depth look into what they've recently discovered. And that can be both in terms of, you know, how he made it and also who he made it for. And then you can also go and see the film, which is going to be in cinemas sometime in April, which is just a recording of the exhibition.
All right. One final question. When will we get our woman writing a letter with her maid? It's on loan from the National Gallery.
Get that back? Yeah, no, she'll be back when this is over and the beginning of June. So, yeah, everyone can go and see her and feel their own Vermeer experience.
Yes, we have our own Vermeer, one of the 37s.
Exactly.
Here in the National Gallery. However, in the meantime, Jessica Fahey there telling me about the exhibition simply called Vermeer, on display at the Rijksmuseum in Amsterdam until June the 4th. You're not going to get it. Well, you might get a ticket. Who knows? Returns, could that happen? But you can get the close-up version of it by going to the website, which is rijksmuseum.nl. Craig Walker, best known to Irish music fans as the frontman of the iconic Dublin band Power of Dreams, who rose to fame in the early 1990s when Craig signed to Polydor Records at the age of just 18. In the intervening years, he has collaborated with a wide range of artists, experimented with an equally wide range of musical genres. In fact, the last time he was with us here in Arena, it was as part of the duo Them There, whose single Fade Out Lines became a Europe-wide electronic dance hit and wound up on the personal playlist of a certain Barack Obama. Craig Walker is back with his latest collaboration, new album, Craig Walker and The Cold. The Cold in question is the stage name of the Canadian producer and writer Eric Alcock, himself no stranger to collaboration, having worked with artists like Eminem and Pink. The debut album from Craig Walker and The Cold is out now. Delighted that Craig is joining us from Berlin, where he is based. We'll be talking to him in a couple of minutes. But first of all, a sample of a track from that album. This is the second track on the album, in fact, features singer Mark Reeder. It's called Electric Shoes. There we go, Electric Shoes from the new album, debut album, in fact, from Craig Walker and The Cold. And delighted that Craig, as I said, joins us now from Berlin. That's a very different sound, Craig, from the last time I was speaking to you about them there, which was a, you know, real electronic dance groove to that. All kinds of influences in there. But what strikes me most is this big theatrical kind of pose and delivery that, that you're giving us there. What was in your mind for this project?
Hi, Sean. Good to hear from you. We really wanted to... This one is very much more influenced by Berlin's musical history, which was something Eric and my partner in The Cold discussed before we started the writing. We wanted the album to, you know, reflect on parts of Berlin that in recent years has been kind of overlooked by the techno scene that's so prominent here. You know, the kraut rock influence of the 70s, which, you know, was massively influential on people like, you know, Bowie, you know, Joy Division, The Fall, from the late 60s and even into from as far back as the late 60s and into the early 70s. So it was formed by that. We really wanted to kind of, you know, give a nod to that. And it also goes further back than that. I mean, it's got a kind of violent Bertolt Brecht kind of oompa to it, which, you know, still resonates in this 2023. So Berlin's always been a city of freedom and expression, and, you know, people like, you know, Ireland's very own Francis Bacon came here in the 1920s and credited that to being the period of his life that he became an artist.
Yeah, and you certainly get a sense that you do get the real sense of that drama that you're talking about, you know, from that era, the Brecht and Weill aspect of things in particular, very much there in Electric Shoes. Tell me a little bit about your pal Mark Reeder, who's involved in that song.
Mark's been living in Berlin since, he's originally from Manchester, and he moved here in 1978, and he's been a resident ever since. And he's been a real integral part of the kind of music fabric here, and was a big instigator of the trance music scene in the early 90s, and, you know, kind of managed, he has a label called MFS Records, which, you know, brought people like Paul Van Dyke to the fore. And his thing goes back even further. You know, he was involved in the post-punk scene in the 80s as well. So he's a good friend of mine. And you know, when we were writing the song, we thought, we need some connection to Berlin and to its musical heritage, and Mark seemed like the obvious choice, you know, and he was more than happy to be involved, which was great.
Absolutely, yeah, and really love how that song came out. But you also haven't forgotten the Dublin origins. That's pretty much there, I think, particularly in the song Junkie Sunset. Tell me a little bit about that.
Oh yeah, I mean that song's about, that was about Dublin. I mean, I said there is a big, massive Berlin influence on the album, but obviously with Eric coming from Canada, there's a North American influence and my Irish influence, of course. Junkie Sunset was a song that it's basically set in Dublin in the 80s when I was a teenager during the whole heroin epidemic, when it seems like, you know, there's people dying every 4 or 5 deaths seemed every day. Like, as a kid, that's what it seemed like to me. I was kind of trying to wrestle back, humanize that, you know, that term junkie was such an ugly word as a kid for me. It just, you know, I just associated it with total darkness. And the song's an attempt to kind of add a bit of, you know, to reclaim those people that died, add a little bit of, humanize them a little bit, and not just brand them as junkies, you know. So there's it's set in Dublin, so it's, you know, talks about the weather in the song, which is an obvious giveaway.
That's one of the giveaways about Ireland. Let's have a listen. A little bit there of Junkie Sunset from the new album from Craig Walker and The Cold. And Craig joining me from Berlin this afternoon. One of the things that really struck me about that song, Craig, and you gave us the setup to it and what was on your mind going into it, but it's the beauty of the melody, that it's a kind of, there's a joyous feel to it, and yet then when you listen into the lyrics, you realise there's a terrible sadness in there as well. I suppose that's what pop music can do better than anything else, is give us lovely music that talks about nasty, horrible things.
Absolutely. I mean, it's kind of that to me, the music, you know, people would always say the Smiths were really miserable, which, you know, if you listen, just listen to the lyrics, but the music counteracted that beautifully, you know, and all the music that I've always loved, the music and lyrics didn't necessarily have to be in the same mood, you know? So that's the great thing about music, is that you can have depth and kind of in the subject matter in pop music, you know? So, once it's dressed up with something that's beautiful, and the idea really was in that song to bring beauty to like an ugly kind of ugly story,
yeah.
You know.
Yeah, so, and as you said, to reclaim that those people who are so easily dismissed, yeah, with just that horrible word junkie episode. Is there have you plans, Craig, to bring this project out on the road?
Absolutely, yeah. We're working on setting up live shows at the moment. I think it'll work really well live. You know, it's quite a big sounding album, and I think it'll work really well to play in a room full of sweaty people. You know,
yeah, and that,
songs come alive.
Yeah, and that theatrical aspect that's in there as well. Although there are some very reflective pieces, Junkie Sunset being one of them,
yeah,
as
yeah.
well. But I wanted to finish up with the opening track on the album. Very hard to look at something called 40 Years and not presume that you were doing some kind of stock take in terms of your own career, which is, you know, 4 decades in the industry.
Yeah, yeah. Well, yeah, I mean, it's funny. Yeah, I guess it could relate to that. But I mean, it was written, I wrote about a friend of mine from Ireland who died a few years ago from alcoholism. He was a brilliant musician and artist, but sadly just couldn't beat it, you know, and died in his mid-30s, 40 years too soon. So the song is really about that. And for me, as somebody who struggled with addiction in the past, I'm acknowledging how lucky I am to still be around today, you know. Some of us get out of those crazy years alive, but many don't, unfortunately. So the 40 years is about, you know, dying too soon.
Yeah. Well, listen, lovely to speak with you again this evening, Craig, and I'll finish up by listening to a little bit of 40 Years and hope you're out and about on the road and heading this direction before too long.
Thanks, Sean. Thanks for having me on. Really appreciate it.
Not at all. That's Craig Walker. And here is that opening track from Craig Walker and the Cold, 40 Years. 40 Years there, the opening track from Electric Shoes, which is the new album from Craig Walker and the Cold. You can check out Craig Walker and the Cold on Facebook, Instagram and other platforms. Craig Walker and the Cold is simply the title that you should look for there. But that is our lot for this Monday evening. Liam Murphy and Paula Shields researched. Demi Garrity was the broadcast coordinator. Mark McGrath was on sound. And tonight's programme was produced by Ola McGowan. Talk to you tomorrow night, 7 o'clock, once again here on RT Radio 1. John Creedon will be with you after the news.